now, In Conversation with the Sunday Independent's Barry Egan, Radio Nova.
This is Barry Egan on Radio Nova, and tonight my guest is one of Ireland's most famous artists, Kevin Sharkey. Welcome to the show. How are you? I haven't seen you in a long time.
I'm very good, thank you, Barry.
Kevin, just in a previous life, you also presented Mega Mix, a rock show for RTE back in the early 80s, and then you did an even bigger show for ITV, The Roxy.
The Roxy, yeah.
Well, what big stars did you interview? I mean, you must have met Jagger and people like that.
Met Mr. Jagger, yes, I did.
What was Mr. Jagger like?
He was okay, actually, a bit of a Jack the Lad. I went to Rotterdam to interview him. They flew me over there, and it was all very touch and go because it was going to be him or Michael Jackson, and Michael Jackson fell through, so I got Mick. And he was cool. He was very, very, very laid back, very down to earth. What was most impressive about him was the size of his
steady
entourage. Huge entourage, massive, like literally the doors flung open, and you just had this tidal wave of fur and Gucci and blondes and glasses, and amazing, just surrounded by 20, 30 people, and they went everywhere with him. Well, that's certainly the time on the day I interviewed him. Yeah. They left with him, they arrived with him, very, very glamorous.
And did he have, he seemed a bit more enthusiastic in the interview before it started.
He was off his head. I was bleeding out.
Was there something?
It was 11 o'clock in the morning. I mean, when we sat down, we were doing this live feed where they said, Kevin, I could hear it in my earphone. I'm not good with headphones and stuff. And they're saying, countdown, Kevin, live in 25, live in 25. Is Mick there yet? And I'm like, no. Kevin, countdown, live in 20. And they're going down and down and down. Mick suddenly pops in out of nowhere, and off we went. And he was lovely. He was a good laugh, charming.
Who else did you meet when you were doing the Roxy?
Oh gosh, we had Flock of Seagulls, we had Chris Rea, we had God, we had everybody, because it was kind of like it was their competition for Top of the Pops. They were there.
Yeah.
It was their kind of like their challenge, I guess. So we did, and there was a lot of bands that supported us who wanted something to be, they wanted something more than just Top of the Pops, because there was that feeling in those days that if you couldn't get on Top of the Pops,
when you say those days, was that kind of late 80s?
Yeah.
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 And through that, you got to know Bob Geldof and became friends.
No, I knew Bob long before then, actually. I knew Bob through Pete Brigette.
In the Boomtown Rats.
In the Boomtown Rats, yeah. I used to write with Pete years ago. And it was with Pete, we wrote the song for Boney M called Everybody Wants to Dance Like Josephine Baker. And, not rock music. However, it was perfectly written and tailored to exactly what they wanted. And they loved it, and they recorded it. And it was the last song they recorded before they split up. So I'd kind of been working with Pete. And it was actually through Pete that I met Kirsty MacColl.
Did you end up working for her?
I used to be Kirsty's cleaner. I used to clean her
eyes. Were you a good cleaner?
I was the best fucking cleaner there was, mate. I was like, I was such a good cleaner that when I went to Kirsty one day and said, Kirsty, I've just gotten a job on RTE television. I'm going to be a presenter. And she goes,
I guess that means you're going to
become a clean anymore. I thought, you fucking heartless bitch. It's my big break and all, she's worried about her cleaning. But I can understand it because, yes, I was a hyperactive cleaner.
But you also, was it when you were going to Kirsty MacColl's, the late great Kirsty MacColl's wedding, didn't you meet someone in the limo?
Yes, Frida from ABBA, which was very surreal because
Frida from ABBA.
There's me all the way from Killybegs in the back of a limo. No, it wasn't a limo, it was a blue Rolls Royce, a bright blue Rolls Royce. And I was pulled into this country lane. Okay, well, Steve was making himself busy entertaining us with,
making a sandwich.
He was making us feel welcome, making us feel at home. But it was such a buzz to be sitting in the back of a limo, back of any car, with Frida from ABBA. I could hardly speak. And she really, literally, she was one of these figures that I knew all the words to all her songs. She sort of floated. She sort of just was a fragrance beyond belief. She was like looking at a rose. Unbelievable. Beautiful woman, but also incredibly wealthy and very attractive. But, a planet all
on
her own.
What kind of music did you like then?
Well, I grew up with, traditional Irish music. I learned Irish dance when I was very young in Donegal, and I loved that music. And I still love to listen to it. Sean Noss music. I only discovered sort of rock.
I mean, you mentioned Mick Jagger, did you like the Stones?
I like certain songs of the Stones. I like the ambiguity of the Stones. I like them in their more laid-back moments. I didn't, white ears and black ears, different instruments. I only discovered this, that white people, I know they've got less wax in their ear, but they hear guitars in the way black people don't. Black people want to feel music in their guts, in their groin area, in their stomach. for me, more rock music is often higher treble. It's less bass.
What would be your favorite Stone song?
Waiting for a Lady, Waiting for a Friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, love that.
It's kind of laid back, silver.
Yeah. And it says something.
Afternoon. Yeah.
And it asks a question. It's exactly. I like music that's a little bit open and ambiguous like that. That doesn't. You know, it's not. That tries to be something other than the usual bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
You know, Steve's music. Steve's did some beautiful work with Simple Minds.
You too, as well, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. Really. And I think, you know, that it's the thing is that, you know, at the time that by the time I got to London, right, you know, I only just discovered I was black, so I'm suddenly like up to my neck in black music, and I'm thinking. You know, suddenly there was ska, there was reggae, there was dub, there's all this music I'd never heard of in Killybegs or Donegal. You know, you just didn't hear it, you didn't hear it on the radio.
Can you tell people who are not aware of your story? You were born in Dublin, Nigerian father.
Well, I was born in Dublin in 1961.
And you put up for adoption when you were 6 months of age.
That's it. My mother was a young girl from Dublin. She was just gone turned 15. And she met my father, who was a medical student at the Royal College, a surgeon from Lagos. His name was Babatunde Akanigaji. Finally found him after all these years. She met him. He didn't know him for very long. Had me. Went to the nuns. The nuns arranged the adoption. They put an ad in the Evening Press. I still have it.
Yeah.
In the miscellaneous section saying, good home wanted for two coloured babies, Kevin and Nicholas. Sharkies in Donegal saw it, Christmas Eve, 1961, contacted them. They said, okay, no problem, you take them. And away I went up to Donegal to Killybegs. So I suddenly was, you know, my new home was a house with six kids already in it. And a mother and a father who were... incredible people in their own right. Like, my father was an inventor, and he'd flown for the English during the war. My mother was, like, you know, she was what they call a blow-in, I guess, a beautiful woman, yeah. But, you know, from out of town.
But they treated you appallingly, Kevin.
They did, yes, yes. And after, it took me years of therapy to be able to say, yes, they did, because for when I was younger, I took a lot of blame for it. But actually, you know, when your mother beats you with a horsewhip, when your father, you know, screams at you to smile in photographs that you won't smile in because you're afraid if your real mother ever sees you, she won't come and rescue from this craziness. And you know.
But there's also stuff like your mother washed your four sisters in the bath, and then
the dog
washed the dog, and then put you in. I mean, that's just
only the ones, and I don't say that in defense, although it sounds like
too much.
It. But yeah, once was too much, and once scarred me in a way that I guess, you know. Before she died, I asked her. I said to her, "You know, why did you adopt me?" It was the question I used to wonder when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And to her credit, she honestly answered, "Because I thought people would think what a wonderful person I was if I did."
Yeah.
It was important in the eyes of the community for her, rather than, you know, it had little to do with me. I was probably, you know, a good idea at the time.
But there was another stage you were sent to a. Was it a mental institution when you were young?
No, they never got me there, thank God, and I never got out. No, it wasn't. When I was 12 and a half, me and my sister were hiding under the bed one day, and my mum got into bed with somebody she shouldn't have, and I never said anything, but my sister...
This was another man, yeah?
Yeah.
It wasn't your father.
And my sister told my dad, and my dad did a terrible thing, really, to both of us. He went in to my mother, and he said, Kevin told me, and I never said word by. I would never have said a word. I was too sus to know that I should just say nothing. So he blamed me.
And your mother took
that moment, she hated my guts. She used to retch when I came into the room. She'd send me up after my...
Were you sent off somewhere?
Yeah. Within 3 months, they'd arrange... Well, me and a lot of other kids in town had gotten into trouble for stealing small things, but there was a court case, and she told me when the judge asked me if I wanted to go away to school that I was to say yes, and of course I didn't want to say yes because this is my family, this is my friends, this is my everything. And
but the place you were sent to, you were treated appallingly as well.
That was the Christian Brothers. Yeah, I think everybody that went to them
was it like a boarding school.
It was worse in a way, Barry, to be honest with you, because it was the first time I ever painted, and it came about because I was so distraught at 12 and a half, having been removed from my family, my friends, everything, my school, everything I knew, even my own bed, I couldn't bring a teddy bear or anything. And at 12 and a half, you're starting to form an identity. You really start to feel like this is part of who you are. So yeah. To have it open, I mean, I was taken away by the cops in the morning. I remember two big fat cops taking me in a Garda car. And it was so shocking because it was such an adult thing. And I was made to feel like I was a bad kid. But in hindsight, it was their way of sort of, I guess, executing me from the picture. It was a very violent way to get rid of me. But the Christian Brothers were brutal. They were
drunk. You were abused in Killybegs by someone we won't mention. And then when you went to the Christian Brothers, I remember you describing it as like a brothel for kids.
It was astonishing because from the very moment I got there, I knew, because the head priest or the head Christian Brother was sitting there with his hands down the trousers of an 8-year-old boy, and I knew enough to know the minute I walked through the door that not only was that not right, but if he was, if he felt confident enough to do that with people walking through and lay staff walking through, then this is a very, very powerful man. So I, like most of the people there, were really seen as nothing other than just, you know, a nuisance. You were there for a reason. You were there because you were bad, you were in trouble, your parents didn't want you. There was nothing, there was no self-esteem in being there. There was no pride, there was no sense of protection or sense of self. It was just basically you were there, and if they decided that to beat you, they could. If they decided to abuse you, they could. If they decided to hit you over the head with a bunch of fucking kids, they could do it. They were the law. And when they weren't, they called in the law's backup. The guards came in and took the kids back, you know. You know, collapsed rectums, children, kids were brought back by the guards from the hospital to there, and the guards never asked, why has the child's rectum collapsed, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard stuff, but, you know, it's easy.
It is hard stuff. Is that why you got into painting? I mean, you're one of Ireland's most famous painters. Is that why you got into painting, to process this insanity that was in your head, to try and understand it?
It's unspoken.
But painting.
Well, my mother used to tell me I was possessed by the devil, and she used to call me Beelzebub from a very young age. And that, I didn't laugh it off because it wasn't funny. But I tried to process it, and you know, it also made me wonder about my own nature and why she did that. And when I started, when I went to Galway after about 6 weeks, I didn't get any letters from my family. Even though I was sending letters, and I didn't find out till years later that she was burning the letters that they were writing to me, and vice versa. So she was making the gap complete. She didn't want me any more part of the family. So I was literally isolated in this place, which was horrible, dark old place full of old creepy guys, really. And you know, a night watchman with a club foot who used to come along at night, like clump, drag, something like The Shining, like freaky for a kid who from a small fishing village in a.
And when did you move up to Dublin?
Tight town. That was pretty horrific. But
or was it straight to London?
Well, no. Just to finish the story about the painting, it was a 12 and a half. I literally cried for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I burst a blood vessel in my eye, and I realized that no amount of crying was going to change anything. So maybe it was time I took a look at what was inside. And the only way I knew,
what did you see?
Well, the only way I knew to do that was to paint. I thought, if I paint something, I wonder what'll come out. Will it be something scary? Will it be something dark? Will it be the devil? You know, like, I really just got this notion that somehow what I was feeling I could maybe learn something from, if I could just get it down onto paper, onto canvas. So I made a little painting that was a black painting with a red square in the middle. And in hindsight, as an adult, I'd say it was about anger, because at that age I wasn't able to be angry with anybody. I wasn't able to be angry with my parents, with
But as 52, you're 52 now, how do you look back on all that? How do you rationalize?
As the beginning of my creative career of the very thing that sparked me up to become what I've become today, like the person that I am today was born out of that.
But how did you go from that to getting on TV and RT, and then going on TV and ITV, and I becoming quite a well-known, you know, personality in England?
Well, I think being driven to prove to people who don't think much of you that you can amount to more than that is an amazingly powerful tool. And I think if you can confide, you know, I used to, as a kid, I never had heroes. I used to always have this notion in my head that if I was going to have a hero, it should be myself. That I should be heroic in my own way, and that I should become in awe of myself because of what I'd achieved and done, rather than have, you know, be fans of other people's talents and really trying just to develop my own. And art became such an important thing. I think the whole creative thing for me was my way out, because it started with cooking. It went into music. I wrote music and songs, and I always painted.
What kind of music did you listen to when you were like in early 20s?
I used to be able to sing Bohemian Rhapsody, every single line, word for word, on the minibus from Glenties to Killybegs on a Saturday night on the way to the dance, where you could only get hang sandwiches and Fantas. There was no alcohol.
And you were lucky to get them.
Yeah, you were lucky to get them, yeah.
Give us a bar of it now.
I'm just another silhouette of a man's caramouche, caramouche.
Bit louder.
Can you do the fandango? Very, very frightening. Galileo, 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 if you go.
Did you ever meet Freddie?
No, unfortunately, no. I served him a drink. I worked in a gay bar in London years ago called Heaven, which was astonishing in hindsight because, one, you'd be serving upstairs, you used to have to wear shorts. And I never made any tips because I was all about the business, serving drinks. All the rest of the guys would be flirting with Freddie Mercury and Susie and the Banshees would be in there. Kenny Everett would be there. I never made tips because I'd be all like, I poured a pint over somebody's head one night and I nearly got sacked because he said something rude. But there were times when it was fun and there were times when it was crazy. But there I met Boy George. I remember being actually in Boy George's flat one morning when Anne Diamond from GMTV was on the telly, yeah, saying, with George's brother, at the time when he turned up somewhere with his face all covered with white powder off his head, and
was this more dandruff? It seems we got
more dandruff. Yes, he had facial dandruff, severe facial dandruff. But we're sitting in his flat in Hampstead, and Anne Diamond is making an appeal to George, who's sitting right beside me eating Häagen-Dazs ice cream off his head, 10 o'clock in the morning, and she's going live. She's going, George, wherever you are, we're concerned. And I'm sitting here thinking, oh, this is rock and roll. Boy George is sitting beside me, and he's just pin-eyed eating his Häagen-Dazs ice cream, looking at Anne Diamond, calling his name while his brother's sitting there beside him. I thought, I must remember this one day. And I did remember, and I put it in my autobiography, which I finally finished last year.
And when can we look forward to reading that?
Well, I hope I don't get arrested when it comes out, because when I worked on the Roxy, they warned me one time that I was going to be late for work. And if I was late the next week, they were going to sack me. So I was thinking, oh, God. And I remember in the morning, the guy who was coming to take me to the airport, he had only one hand. He was a driver. And he was always...
How did you drive the car?
Very, very, very difficult. He sometimes used to have to change the gears.
Oh,
this guy could roll a joint with his one hand. He was a genius. But you used to sometimes have to change the gears. But he was taking me to get to the airport in time for this flight, and I was late. And he says, you're not going to make it, Shark. And I'm going, I'm going to be sacked. And I'm going, quick, pull into this little chef. So we pull into the little chef. I get on the telephone, and I go on, I get the number of the airport, and I call up the airport, and I said, hello, this is the IRA here. There's a bomb on flight 742 going to Newcastle. Delta B72, put the phone down. We get to the airport, and I go in. I say, I think I'm late for my flight. And she goes, oh, no, it hasn't taken off just yet. So she's there with her all other thing going, no, there seems to be a problem. I can put you on the next flight now. I'm saying, when does that get up? And she said, oh, it should be there in half an hour. Turns out I get to Newcastle at 12:30, only to find out at 6 o'clock when Cliff Rhea, España, Bananarama, and Rick Astley finally are allowed off the airplane where they've been kept all afternoon, having to identify the luggage several times by security because they believe there was a bomb on the plane. So I got there in time.
I don't know why we're laughing, because this is not funny.
It's not funny, and you shouldn't try this at home. It's not recommendable. But yes, I decided when I did the autobiography it would be better to put everything in and let the lawyers take out what they needed to, but it should make for a very good read.
And what's the status of, it seems like ever fluctuating, your sexuality? Is Kevin Sharkey gay or straight, or does it matter? Because you've been engaged to men and women.
Yes, this is a good point. You know what? I it's like President Michael Higgins once said to me.
Who's a friend of yours?
He's a good friend of mine. And he said, you know, it's funny, life is a bit like that sometimes. You go down roads, and certain roads are cul-de-sacs. Other times you find a crossroads. And I found that I would say that predominantly I would describe myself as a gay man.
Yeah.
And I've never said that before because I've never really felt the truth of that before. But I know that for years I had an ongoing need to want to have what everybody else had, you know, the illusion of a family, of marriage. We were brought up in tradition.
Because you said that Boy George felt safe when he was doing heroin. Did you ever feel safe because of your childhood?
No.
Because like a child should expect to be safe.
Apparently.
Around his parents. And you never had that.
But then I guess I turned the sense of terror into a sense of excitement and found ways to, you know, make it work for me so that I could process it, because you can't, you know, with your mother pours a pot of piss over your head when you're 8 years old of age. You have no way to process that other than to talk to yourself as a child at that point. And I do think For me, that was a pivotal moment because I should have been angry, but I couldn't be. I should have been outraged, but I couldn't be. Yeah. I had no option but to just silently go and clean myself. And in that rage that was undoubtedly in me, that would be in anybody treated like that, something creative in me just kept flickering. And I'd always would be making something, making some food, making a little thing for my sister, making a boat, making, you know, making. And that's all I do. I make music, I make painting, I make love when I can.
Yeah.
And I look after my dogs, and I'm very lucky that I've got...
What are your dogs' names?
A Life of Balance. Peggy is one of my dogs, who's called after my mum. She's beautiful. She's a gorgeous little thing. And it's lovely to be able to use that name and have it associated with love, because I was with my mother before she died. And while we had a terribly turbulent relationship, there was nothing but love between us when she died. It was love and forgiveness. And
did you reconcile it with your biological mum?
My biological mum, curious enough, when I met her, she really didn't want to know. I think it was just one of those things that was far in the past, and she felt it was better left. In fact, curious enough, one of the things I mentioned to you earlier, and that I thought I would mention, is I think Paul McGrath is very, very likely to be my brother.
Really?
I think the chance of Paul not being my brother would be 1,000,000 to 1, given that I found out that, and I've never spoken about this before publicly, but I found out years ago when I heard Paul speaking, I thought it was me on the radio one time, and I listened, and I just thought it was odd. And then years later, when I found out about my father coming from Nigeria and being from the Royal College of Surgeons, I went and asked them, and they said, we only had one student here from Lagos in 1961, and his name was Babatunde Akanigaji. So I never really thought about it much till years later. And then I heard Paul being interviewed a few times, and I wondered about his father. And then a friend of mine, Alison O'Reilly, called me one night about 6 months ago and said, oh my God, Paul has just been on the Late Late Show. And they asked him who was his father. And he said, he doesn't know, but that he was a medical student at the Royal College of Surgeons in 1961. And I said, but that's impossible, because there was only one from Lagos, that he was from Lagos.
What age is Paul?
Paul would be a year younger than me. 12 months younger than me. So here's the thing, Barry, though. When I found my dad, I found out that I had 15 brothers and sisters I'd never met. So Paul, the chances... So I wrote to Paul. I got his email and I sent him an email. I said, Paul, look, we haven't ever met. My name's Kevin. I'm an artist. And I know you don't know much about your dad. I think my people will give you some facts. And he never wrote back, which I thought was very telling.
Maybe
I thought
when he's ready one day.
I'd love to think so, because he seems like a lovely soul and a very gentle soul, and I would love just if only to give...
Yeah.
If, you know, because when you meet 15 black people that your brothers, you suddenly realise what's, you know, my dad was some worker.
Yeah. If I was to walk around your house and looked through the CDs, what kind of stuff would I find?
You'd find a lot of CDs of new songs that I'm working on with Colm Sexton, who's an amazing guitarist, very moody, slow. But then when I go out in the day, I put In Excess on for the dogs.
What's your favourite In Excess?
Need You Tonight. Yeah. Then the dogs love it.
Yeah.
Like, I put it on every day before I go out, so I leave music on for them. What else do the dogs love? They love me singing. The Babu, when you sing, Babu's the other dogs. Babu, Peggy, and Happy.
And do you pretend to be Michael Hutchins for them?
No, I just sing a Turalura he loves. And he gets up on the bed and starts putting his two hands together.
What about gigs? Do you go to gigs?
No, because I prefer... I often get disappointed by the performance. I'd rather listen to Amy Winehouse than watch her stumble around the stage. Amy Winehouse, I adore, but it was so sad that she wasn't just a recording artist, that they tried to make her into a performing artist. God help her, she wasn't cut out for that. And what an amazing talent. So, no, her I love.
What about a favourite song by Amy Rubin?
Love is a Losing Game.
Is it? Has it been for Kevin Sharkey?
Well,
are you in love at the moment?
I'm in love with my life at the moment. I'm in love with being back in Dublin. I'm in love with Dublin. I love Dublin at the moment with all its bits and bobs. And I love also, I didn't tell you, I'm in a couple of films at the moment. I'm acting in a great movie called Dog Eat Dog, and I've just done the soundtrack for that. So
don't let the dogs hear that.
Send you a copy of that. No, there's dogs in it, so they start barking every time they hear it. I had to do something for them.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for coming in.